Well, today it's my privilege to introduce our guest lecturer, Dr. Michael S. Benninger. And Mike received his undergraduate degree from Harvard University in 1978, and following that matriculated to Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, where he received his medical degree in 1983. He completed his residency in general surgery at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation in Cleveland, Ohio, in 1985, and stayed there and completed his otolaryngology head and neck surgery residency in 1988. Upon completion of his residency, Mike began his professional career as a senior staff otolaryngologist at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, Michigan. In 1992, he was appointed chairman of the Department of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery and the Cummings Brush Chair in Surgical Education for the Henry Ford Health System. Mike also serves as the director of Henry Ford's Center for the Performing Artist and co-director of its Professional Voice Clinic. Dr. Benninger's involvement in our specialties, professional societies, and associations is well established. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery, and is a former vice president and chairperson of the Board of Governors of the AAO-HNS. He is a past president of the American Rhinological Society and the Michigan Otolaryngology Society. At the most recent annual meeting of the American Laryngological Association, Mike was elected to the council and installed as its treasurer. He also serves as editor-in-chief of our specialty's largest peer-reviewed journal, the White Journal, Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. He has authored and co-authored numerous scientific articles and book chapters with the primary focus on voice care and laryngology, nasal and sinus disease, and healthcare management, and has authored at least 5 books, with his most recent just having been published, The Singer's Voice. Dr. Benninger lectures on both the national and international circuit in our specialty and brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to the field of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery. Please join me in welcoming Mike Benninger as our 14th Adams Lecturer. The subject of his talk this morning is Principles and Pearls for the Ethical Peer Review Journal Publishing. Mike?
Well, thank you, Dr. Ossoff. It's a great thrill to be here. This Vanderbilt seems like family to me. Not only am I very close with a number of the faculty here, there's been a fairly strong relationship between our department and the department here. The Jacobsons, Barb and Gary, were with us, and Devin was with us, and Bill Dickinson was with us, and 2 of my faculty trained here as fellows, Glenn Gardner in laryngology, and Mumtaz Khan, who unfortunately just left us to go back to Pakistan in head and neck. And from what I understand from Dr. Netterville, one of our residents will be joining him next year as one of his head and neck fellows. So it really is a great pleasure to be here. It's always a great pleasure to attend events like this, because why are we all in academic medicine? It's because of residency training. And to hear the work that I've heard thus far, and I'm sure I'm going to hear this afternoon, is really makes all of us in academic medicine feel proud that we participate in training programs. And congratulations to the speakers already this morning. This lecture, by the way, do we have a pointer? May not need it, but this lecture is really going to do an overview of publishing. And one of the things about being an editor, and Dr. Ossoff can attest to this, is that you learn more by being an editor than you did any other time in your life. You learn a lot about publishing. My focus as editor of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery has been to focus on ethical issues in publishing. So a fair amount of what I'm going to discuss here will really be related to ethics of publishing. But for the residents and the junior faculty, I hope that some of this information will also be helpful in relationship to just how to go about publishing, what you should do, etc. The ethical issues of highest concern that I'll talk about today are informed consent, which is probably the most important, patient confidentiality, duplicate publication and other copyright issues, authorship, conflict of interest, and plagiarism. And you think about, wow, that's a big package. But in every article that you write or you read, these things should cross your mind. I feel that they're critically important. So one of the fundamental questions is should I publish at all? And the things that I do when I consider publishing, and I can tell you, I've published some really bad stuff. I think anybody who's we look back at some of the things we've done, and even some of the recent things, and I say, what did I do? Why did I do that? And some of it's an effort just to publish, and that may or may not be the best reason. Clearly, in academic medicine, publish or perish still is the case. In order to advance academic rank, you really have to publish. And where you publish may be important also. But does it really add to the literature? Fundamentally, will it eventually impact patient care? To me, that's the most important question. Some of the basic science work we saw today, it's useless to do that basic science work unless at some point in the future it's going to impact patient care. Will it lead to further research and discovery? And that's also important. So maybe some of the things that you're doing now may never get there, but it may stimulate other people to do research that will lead to that. Will it lead to personal advancement and promotion? Clearly important for all of us. And will it support the career or development of others? Sometimes we do things and we publish because we want to help other people get used to publishing or advance their career. So there are lots of reasons we do this. There are a lot of different types of articles that you can do, from original articles to review articles to brief scientific communications. Some of the most influential and important articles that have ever been written have been less than 2 pages long. Watson and Crick's description of the DNA molecule was 2 pages, if I recall. The first report of AIDS was a letter to the editor, and it was 2 paragraphs or something. So, you know, you look at these kind of things, and they could be very important. There are new techniques. So the technology that was described today, the stapler, you may, once that's patented and applicable, before you have a lot of data, you may just want to describe the device in a paper. Letters to the editors, editorial. So there are lots of things you can do, and each of them have an important role. Now, what those roles are vary a lot by what you're trying to accomplish, and a lot by what the small message is or large message is that you want to get out. The most important studies are prospective studies. I mean, basic science is a little bit different, but all basic science, for the most part, is prospective. But prospective studies generally should be published, or at least submitted. The work is done, the data speaks for itself. If it's a well-done prospective study, it's probably publishable. Case reports, any more case reports, usually should not be published. We got in a difficult situation with our journal because we accepted a lot of international case reports, and they really weren't very good, and now we're 2 years behind trying to publish case reports. But there are case reports that are critical. Many times I'll look at a case report and say, oh, I didn't know that, or this is something new for me. Review articles are actually the most referenced works. And so review articles, if done well, really add a lot of value because you don't have to go through 60 articles to get that message, and particularly those things that are done by committees from the academy and things like that, because they're so well thought out. Those are very helpful articles. Some of the things that people have done in the past, I'll give you one of my own for instances. I had an article that I submitted to the Laryngoscope, and I had one of my mentors participated a bit, but he didn't think he did enough to be an author. This is back when I was a resident, and it got flatly rejected. We resubmitted the exact same article to the Laryngoscope and included his name as an author, and it was accepted with no revisions. Those times are gone. So having Dr. Ossoff and having his name attached to the article 30 years ago would have automatically meant that you would get it published. And now the people are really looking at it for their merit. And any of the journals, particularly our journal in the Laryngoscope, received so many more articles than we could possibly publish that we're about a 50% rejection rate. I think the Laryngoscope is about a 60% rejection rate at this time. And with electronic submissions, we get so many articles from all over the world that unless it's really good, it's probably not going to be published. Now, I can't say that everything we publish is earth-shattering, but the quality of the work that's being published in the ENT journals now in comparison to 10 years ago is much better. And that's why it's much more difficult for you to get things published, and that's why your science has to be that much better. Authorship has been a real issue. And this is a statement made by Ron Bailey, who, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the most ethical editors that I've ever met. Authorship credit is based only on having made a substantial contribution to the published work. How you define that varies, but a substantial contribution to the published work. Each author should sign off on the final submission. I cannot tell you how many times I've gotten authors sending me a note saying, this paper was revised, they added some information, I didn't agree to it, I want my name pulled from the article after the article's already already published. The order of author should be based on the amount of work you do. So the era of having the last author be the most senior author probably isn't accurate if that senior author did the second most amount of work. They should really be second on the paper. And the first author should be the person that does the most work, not the person who has the biggest reputation. Some of the things that I look at is if I see an article submitted to me and it's a relatively small piece of work and it has 14 authors, it raises a question, and you see these, it raises a question for me, is this just CV cushioning or is this really authorship? Most of those articles get rejected. Now, there's collaborative trials. You get, Brian, I think, presented a collaborative trial. There'll probably be a lot of authors on, or who did, the cochlear implant. A lot of those, you'll probably have a lot of authors because it's multi-institutional collaborative trial, and in each institution there may be two or three people working on that. So that's different because it's multi-institutional. Where do you start? Develop an hypothesis. And I will tell you, I was very impressed with the presentations this morning and that everybody presented a hypothesis before they presented their work. And that's really the first step. Determine if it's already been done. I was in the middle of doing an evidence-based review looking at cephalosporin versus penicillin cross-allergenicity. And we were 6 months into the project, and Mike Pekicaro published the exact same thing in Pediatrics, and his work was better than what we were doing. So I spent 6 months spinning my wheels. Now, I wouldn't have known that, but make sure somebody else hasn't done it already. Determine the type of study, whether you're going to do prospective or retrospective, controlled or non-controlled, blinded or non-blinded. And then this next point is probably the most important. Once you've done that, particularly with any prospective trials, establish a sample size. I mean, you can't just start working and say, well, we're going to look at this prospective trial and we're going to see how people do. You really need to establish a sample size. Sometimes that's hard, but probably the most significant deficiency in most of the papers I see is that inappropriate sample size justification. A perfect example is in acute sinusitis, there's all these comparative trials, and they'll say that drug X is equivalent to drug Y. And none of those had a sample size for equivalence. Their power was based on non-inferiority. And so in our journal, when they say equivalent, I tell them, are you sure that your sample size was justified for equivalence, when the reality is it was justified for non-inferiority, and so they have to put in their conclusions, drug X is non-inferior to drug Y, and those are two very, very different things. Garbage in equals garbage out. Be creative, be original, okay? Be honest. Your name is going to be attached to this work. So fudging data and things, that's fudging your own name and reputation. Take advantage of expertise of your mentors and faculty. You have unique opportunities, residents here, for having such an outstanding faculty, terrific basic science research, great hearing and speech departments, and take advantage of these people. Do the statistical assessment by somebody knowledgeable. The other thing I see is people take their statistics and dump it into a chi-squared table out of their Excel spreadsheet or whatever, and they call that statistical assessment. Doesn't work like that. I mean, whether or not you have to use some other statistical methodologies. Create a good method for controlling your data. The problem we all have is we often have so much data that we don't have a way of controlling it very well. Good data management will save you a lot of work. And so putting it in a mechanism that you can access very freely, easily, is great. Don't obtain data unless you're going to use it. One of the things we tend to do, particularly with clinical trials, is we obtain way too much information. Then we've got all this data sitting out there and we don't know what to do with it. If you ask a specific question, develop your database around that specific question. Now, there will be times where you'll need some superfluous information that may be important, but at least you've thought through, where will I use that data in the future? Do the work, make it a priority, leave time for setbacks and misfires. Can everybody read that? That's how I feel sometimes, you know, like you're spinning in circles, but science is often trial and error, and you find that what you plan to do, you get to the point and you say, I can't do that, I've got to modify my procedures or whatever. If you do major modifications, particularly in patient care trials, you need to let the IRB know. Okay, you can't just make modifications in a trial, or animal care is the same way, with animal or patient care, without letting your IRB or Animal Rights Committee know. Which leads us to Institutional Review Board approval. There is almost no study that should be done related to humans or animals that does not require IRB approval. Okay, there should be almost none. There are some database analysis that you can do from corporate data stores or billings and things where you don't really need an IRB approval because there's no identification whatsoever. But any place that you can even presumptuously identify a patient, you should have IRB approval. And it is the single most important reason that I reject well-done articles in our journal. It's a little bit difficult because we have a lot of international submissions, and they are IRB approval process may be very, very different. And then what I ask them is equivalence, and read the Declaration of Helsinki, the Helsinki Accord. As long as they meet those criteria, we'll accept them, and as long as their university is supportive of that. Informed consent and patient confidentiality. Patient confidentiality is a huge deal. If you were that patient, you want to have confidential. You want your data and your information to be kept confidential. Recently at Madison, Wisconsin, they're not allowed to participate in multi-institutional trials comparing stroboscopy data because their IRB feels that a stroboscope is a voice signature, that each voice is a signature and is identifiable. I think that's a little extreme, but maybe not. James Earl Jones' voice was on that, could not anybody in this room identify that was James Earl Jones with that voice of his? So maybe they're right, but that's an important thing to do. Evaluate your data, write your paper, and stick to your point. Write the paper based on your hypothesis, not on the data that you ultimately get. And unless something is extraordinarily is revealed through the data. So you may say, wow, we found out this, but that's usually not the case. Once you do that, follow the guidelines to the letter by the journal that you're submitting it to. Okay, it'll save you a huge amount of time. We had a recent paper that we sent back to the author four times just to get them to do all their copyright releases and whatever. It added 4 months to the review process. Appropriately determine your authorship again. Read all the references that you will use in your article. I cannot tell you how many times something has been misquoted, and nobody has gone back and read the original article to determine that the first person that quoted it incorrectly. So I think it's unethical to reference articles that you have not read, unless you state that this was a reference of a reference. Do not be frustrated if you're asked to make revisions. Most articles will require revisions. The peer reviewers are usually expert in their field, and their comments almost always improve the quality of your work. Now, not always the case, but almost always. If the revisions are not possible without dramatically changing your methods and things like that, well, that's a different question altogether, and you may need to let them know. There are times where I'll get direct contact by an author that says, the reviewers are misunderstanding what I'm trying to say, or I believe the reviewers are biased. And when that happens, I either review it myself in addition or send it to another reviewer to see if those comments are accurate. But you have that right to communicate directly with the editors. And Bob, I don't know how many times you get things, but we get those. And usually the author's correct when I get a letter like that. The quicker you are with your revisions, the faster until the acceptance or rejection. So when you get a paperback, turn it over. Get it done quickly. Publishing negative studies is something that it's hard to get negative studies published. I mean, we've had some unbelievable negative studies that we couldn't get anybody to publish because it's not very attractive. But negative studies are probably as important, maybe more important than positive studies. And one of the problems I've had with industry is up until recently, industry often would not publish your negative studies, so you wouldn't know those studies. You'd only know the positive studies. Now, most companies, Novartis is an example, they contractually make sure that every single study that they do is submitted for publication. It may not be accepted, but each is submitted for publication. And as of January of 2005, PhRMA, which is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America members, all are voluntarily posting their current studies that are in the pipeline so that you can go in and find out what work is being done with which drugs. And then if 3 years from now you find out that no summary paper was published, then you can question whether or not that's valid. Duplicate publications has become a real bone of contention for the ENT journal editors. And there's lots of duplicate publications. There's exact duplicate publications. We currently have one where it was the exact same article was published in the Mayo Clinic's proceeding and then in our article, in our journal. In our review process, we can go right in and look at everything published by those authors or similar topics. And unfortunately, they were submitted around the same time, so they were both in the review process, and we didn't know about it till after they were published. We are formally retracting the article from our journal, and we are putting in place mechanisms so that it cannot be referenced. The authors are writing a letter to the editor apologizing to the public for their duplicate publication. A year from now, those authors will be censored. And I'll tell you a little bit about what the editors are doing to censor authors like that. So exact publications in different types of journals in different countries. I've had some where they've published it in a British journal and one in us, and in different languages. I had one that was exactly the same thing. I wouldn't have known it, except for a person that read both Polish and English called me and said, this is the exact same article. I've had one where one of our articles was actually submitted in another language by an author who had nothing to do with it. All he did was take that article, translate it, and submit it in another language. So these things are out there. Probably more important is salami slicing. And that's taking one study and then doing a little article here, a little article here, a little article here in three different journals based on the same database. So you're looking at different outcomes. One may look at hearing, one may look at balance, but the same patient population. There are times where that may be appropriate if the data is so magnanimous. We have one that we just did. It's a gerbil model of cholesteatoma. There was so much there that we really split it into three separate articles, part one, part two, and part three. And that's appropriate because you know that one is building on the other. And it's just a space issue. But salami slicing is something that's not appropriate or ethical. And then reporting small incremental numbers of subjects. So we've had an author that we just sent letters to admonishing the fact that we've seen four articles published by them, 15 patients, 20 patients, 25 patients, and 30 patients with the exact same thing, almost exactly written the same way, same method, same everything, and in four different journals.
Michael?
Yes? Well, first thing is referencing your other article is critical. So everybody knows this is a step. I would say it's probably not worth publishing that unless there's something important to tell. And it may be that 10-year follow-up justifies our 3-year follow-up. For many things, cancer, for example, that's critically important, right? To be, know that you've got 10-year survival rather than just 3-year survival. Number two is you may find something unique about that data source that you didn't expect and didn't report in the first data. Here's what we found is different. There may be changes in the general disease entity. We published an article 10 years ago about the changing etiology of vocal fold paralysis. We're doing it again. Now we're looking at that time we had 800 patients and we're going to have 2,000 patients, because we want to know, is it still changing? Are we still seeing different etiologies? But the fundamental question was, is there still a change? It's not, are we going to present just a larger number? So I would say that if you think it's an important message that should be told, rather than I just want to report my experience, then I would say it's completely justifiable. Just make sure you reference all your other works.
What about chapters versus peer-reviewed journals versus duplication?
Chapters meaning?
A book chapter.
Oh, that's a different question altogether.
Okay.
I mean, a book chapter. The other thing is many of us have been asked to write review articles for more than one journal. I mean, I've been asked to write 3 or 4 chronic rhinosinusitis review articles, most of it based on one large article we wrote. There's not that much new information, so a lot of it is somewhat duplicative, but I reference all those other things and let them know that was there. It's when people, I can't tell you how many times people do these articles and don't even reference their first article, and then you know in your mind they're trying just to get a publication. Book chapters are very, very different because they're a summary of your experience. And let me just caution you about book chapters. Book chapters are a very bad source of information, okay? I know that seems crazy because we all use book chapters. I've written hundreds of book chapters. In comparison to a peer review article, for 2 reasons. Number one, it's an opinion of one author, okay? There's no peer review process involved with it. And oftentimes for books like Cummings' book, where I've written chapters there, it's 3 years after you write the chapter before the book is written, because there's so much material and it's so hard to write a book. So when you read a book chapter, read it for the gestalt and for technical things. Don't read it as if it's gospel, okay? And those of us who have written book chapters realize that that's the case, because I have an opinion about vocal fold paralysis that may or may not be justified by the literature, and if it's not peer-reviewed, it may not be accurate. Now, that's typically not the case, but they're not always the best source of information. By the way, duplicate publications, it is copyright infringement. It is against the law, okay? The Mayo Clinic proceedings threatened to take legal action against our journal if we did not do what we were planning on doing anyway, retract the article for copyright infringement. Plagiarisms. Okay, plagiarism is another one that's kind of hard to tell, but there's many types of plagiarism. There's direct copying, there's copying themes, there's not referencing comments or data, there's excessively long quotes, and I don't know what those are, but taking references from one paper to justify a point but not referencing it. In other words, doing what I said before, you know, you take a reference from another article and you include it in yours to justify a point that the other author really created, okay? This was stated back in 1933, when you steal from one author, it's plagiarism. If you steal from many, it's research, probably. But there are places that you can go. And these are actually from the federal government copyright website. And there are no legal rules permitting the use of a specific number of words. So be reasonable about it. However, the person considering using this work should take into consideration the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relationship, in relation to together, the copyrighted work as a whole. And you can look those up in the website. This was a consortium that we put together of otolaryngology head and neck surgery editors. Ron Bailey and I started this about 5 years ago, and every year now at COSM, the Trial Society sponsors it, and every year at the Academy meeting, the Academy sponsors our luncheon, and we meet together to discuss ethical issues. And we published this back in 2005, that we were going to start taking censorship action for egregious acts of ethical breaches in publishing. We just met at COSM, and Jonas Johnson has drafted the actual process by which we will do that. And we are potentially looking at anywhere from 6 months to 3 years of censorship from all of our journals, depending on the severity of the act. Now, what that also will do will mean you can't present at most of our meetings, because you present at the American Rhinologic Society, you've got to submit to the American Journal of Rhinology. If you present at the Trial Society, you have to submit to the Laryngoscope. We hope that this will take away some of these really remarkably egregious acts of misethics. Is that a word, misethics? Correct.
Are they retracting it?
No, because they were published first. So by copyright laws, they actually have the right to the manuscript.
So essentially, then, the article could be out there, it can't be referenced. So is that really harmful to the authors?
Well, it's harmful in that it's acknowledged that they've done it. It's harmful to us because not only did they... do we have an article that can't be referenced, so it hurts our ISI ranking and all these other things... There's another author that couldn't get an article published in our journal because these guys duplicated an article.
Now, but when they submitted it to Mayo Proceedings,
did they not have to sign? Yep, they signed for both of the journals that they were not submitting it anywhere else.
And Mayo Proceedings is not doing that?
Well, they submitted to Mayo Proceedings a month before they submitted to us. So at the time it was submitted there, they had not. I'm telling you, this is going to be a scary thing coming forward, and we want it to be. We want people to believe that this is important. Let's just talk a couple minutes about conflict of interest. I put the word competing interest because many times what we have is what people perceive as a conflict isn't really a conflict. It competes. It competes with our thought process, etc. But any relationship that could even be potentially influence the results of the study should be acknowledged. Any potential one. Sometimes you won't need to put it in the paper and let the editor determine how they recognize that. This does not necessarily imply that there's a bias. Now, if this is funded by a pharmaceutical company or through an NIH grant, it needs to be in somewhere in the article. Absolutely has to be there. Usually these things don't create bias. The audience has the right to know, though, and they can make their own decisions. And do not assume that a relationship does not need to be divulged. If you aren't sure, there are two options. You can err on acknowledging things, or number two is you can contact the editor and ask them, should I acknowledge this? I mean, it's just like when I'm doing the CME here. I've got a relationship with Zomed Medtronics for microinstruments. This afternoon, I'm not going to mention it one little bit, but when I filled out my form, I put it there just to make sure that if it ever came up, that I've divulged that in my agreement, and you should do that. Things to acknowledge for sure are industry relationships and any source of funding. So if you do have an NIH grant, which most people want to do because they want to advertise they have an NIH grant, so you want to tell people you have that, but and other funding sources. Now, this is kind of a question. We talked about this at dinner last night. What is the major reason that authors admit to that has resulted in manipulation of data results or conclusions? So this was a large survey done in 1999 where a huge number of authors were asked to anonymously state whether or not they had manipulated data. Surprisingly, about 10% had. And what was the major reason that they did that? Anybody? Somebody can yell it out. That's it. It's not industry relationships. It's desire for promotion. At the Academy a few years ago, there was a dean there that said that no relationship with industry should be allowed because it results in fraudulent publications. The reality is the major reason that people actually manipulate data is because they want to move from associate professor to a professor and they need to get their data published. So the ivory towers aren't necessarily any more ivory than is industry. So you have to kind of look at the motivation, and it is a competing interest. We do need to publish papers to get advancement, but we should do that ethically. Well, what about the review process? This is one of my favorite Farside one. If people can't read it, well, this guidebook is worthless. It just says these people worship two gods. One was all-knowing and one was all-seeing, but they don't tell us which is which, for crying out loud. And that's what I feel like sometimes when I'm reviewing papers, is I have no clue what's going on. But the review process is peer-reviewed publications rely on the review process to assure a lot of different things. Methods, data, results, conclusion, reduce potential bias or conflict of interest, improve readability and presentation, to reduce redundancy. Many of these things come up through our review process. And although the New York Times and other our magazines and papers have stated that it's the editor's responsibility to make sure the data is accurate, there's just no way we could possibly do that. I mean, I can't pull all your raw data and do a statistical analysis to make sure that what you submit me. So we rely on the review process. The editorial board does various things for the journal, just to know that there's a lot of steps in this process. Reviewers and referees may or may not be members of the editorial board. Usually they're not. They play a critical role in the editorial process. That's what separates peer review from book chapters. They participate because they're knowledgeable or have an area of expertise. Some reviewers, I've got a guy, does anybody know Neil Bhattacharya? I mean, Neil Bhattacharya is probably the most prolific human being I've ever met in my life. He's been out of his fellowship 5 years, and he probably has 100 papers, and they're all very good. I've sent him probably 20 papers a year. He does every one. I mean, he's just one of those guys that does it. The thing is, if you're a reviewer, you should acknowledge if you have a potential conflict of interest related to this paper. So if I'm reviewing an article on sinusitis and I have a relationship with a company, I should let the editor know. You may be the right expert anyway. If you're the only person who knows about this, that's okay. But they need to know that there's a potential bias there. Same thing true if you're writing a letter to the editor. You should acknowledge any bias. We identify them through lists, through the reviewers, through the associate editors. If it's a very obscure topic, we'll actually look at the references and pull somebody from the reference and ask them if they want to be a reviewer. If you're asked to serve as a reviewer, do it. It is a terrific experience. When I was a resident, I wrote a paper my second year. In my fourth year, I was asked to review a paper. I was stunned. I'm a resident reviewing a paper because it was a very narrow topic. It was on pseudotumor cerebri, and there wasn't much in our literature about it, and they asked me to review a paper. And you learn a lot by reviewing. You learn about writing. You learn about methodology, et cetera. If you're unsure of statistics when you're doing a review, ask the editor to have a statistician take a look at it. And finally, or you can have one of your own statisticians take a look at it. And only when you're really, really well established, like Dr. Ossoff, and he does all the reviews for us anyway. He's an associate editor on our journal, so he does more work than he probably should anyway. But when you're really established and you're being asked, I mean, I get asked to do 2 or 3 reviews a week, and I'm still editing a journal, I'm refusing some of those. I just can't do it all. Once it's submitted, it's processed. It's sent to usually 2 reviewers, for us sometimes 3, depending on what the work is. And it comes back either to accept and a level of prioritization for the acceptance, where there's minor, major revisions or reject. Minor revisions are kind of taken care of fairly quickly. You just send them back and we accept them. Major revisions are usually re-reviewed completely by all the reviewers and the associate editors. And you have an opportunity, if you're rejected, to send back and say, I don't believe this was a fair decision. And I've overturned some decisions by our editorial board with further reviews. The editor and the editorial board are ultimately responsible for the final disposition. Reviewers typically are not. They send their comments in and we make the judgment. And in my case, I ultimately am responsible for everything that's published in our journal, but I really rely on our associate editors who are more knowledgeable in their field. Mike Simon, for example, in otology, or Dennis Krause in head and neck, they know those areas better than I do, so I rely on them to give me the judgment that we need. Let me tell you a little bit about time. The reason it takes a long time to publish an article is because there are many, many steps in the process. Currently, right now, you have to submit it, you have to catalog it. With electronic submissions, it's much quicker, it's much easier. They're already into Adobe. You have to convert them into Adobe files. Then they're sent to reviewers. We've got to get the reviewers to accept. Some of the reviewers say no, so we have to send it to another reviewer. So that process takes a long time, and then they're returned to authors. Currently, for otolaryngology head and neck surgery, the average time between submission and return to authors the first time is 14 days, currently in our journal, which is remarkable, and electronic submissions have had that. The time between the first sent to the authors and their revision is 7 weeks on average. So the biggest part of the delay in the process currently now is actually in the hands of the authors. And so we've actually initiated that if we don't get it back in 6 weeks, we're rejecting the article. So you have 6 weeks to make your first revisions for us. And then once it's accepted, you got to get galleys done, and there's formatting and printing, and those take about 2 months to do that. So in the best scenario, you're looking 3 months from submission to publication, and that's if there was no backlog of articles. So that's why it takes so long. Supplements often provide a more thorough review of a topic, could be a single or multi-authored. We tend to use 3 peer reviewers for supplements, only because it's more data and oftentimes are underwritten by industry. A little bit about how journals are rated. Basically, they're rated by something called ISI ratings, and there are 2 different ways to look at it. Total number of citations, so the number of times an article from your journal is cited in another journal. And so that's called the impact factor, and that's over a certain finite period of time. And that's what most people use as the most substantive of all the citation indices. There are some others. There's an immediate index, immediacy index, which means how quickly is it cited. So if it's really something hot, it's going to be cited pretty quickly. Now, it still takes time for those other articles to be published. And then there's a half-life citation that we measure. But there are other measures that our journal takes into consideration. Percent readership. I'm not going to tell you which journals, but currently now, otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, 87% of the people that subscribe to the journal read it. One of our other major journals with a similar ISI ranking has a 45% readership. So for us, we'd rather have people read the article. Total circulation is important. The bigger the circulation, the more people get access to it. Paid subscriptions are important. That's where the money comes in. Distribution of subscribers, whether it's international or not, and individual subscriber perception, and there's something called PERC data that we measure satisfaction, just like you would with patients. This was just last week in the Wall Street Journal. Anybody read this article? Science journals artfully try to boost their rankings. So many of the journals with very high ISI rankings actually have done it artificially. And here's how they do that. They cross-reference in their own journal. They quoted an article in that Wall Street Journal where when the article was submitted, it was accepted, but it was sent back for revisions asking them to include more references from their journal. Okay? Can you imagine that? I mean, summary articles, self-referencing. There is a journal that you guys probably all see, not in our specialty, but many of us get, where once a year they do summary articles for the whole year in each topic, and they reference every article that was published in that year. That gives them an ISI of 1, okay, automatically. Every article has been cited. And it's done purposely for that. Commentaries, there's a couple of journals. Well, what they do is we will occasionally have a commentary about once every 2 months or 3 months. There'll be an important enough issue that we'll have one of the editors or somebody else write a commentary. There's one journal that many of us get where they will have 4 or 5 commentaries each issue. Each of those commentaries are in the numerator, but they're not in the denominator. Plus, each of those commentaries reference the article that they're commenting on. So they're automatically increasing. So look at things not and how it's done. If you put it as a case report, it appears in your denominator. If you include it as a clinical vignette, it's not, even though it's the same thing. Okay, so that affects it. Editor's choice, editorials, there are lots of ways they could do it. So why does it matter? Because promotion may depend on the quality of the journal determined by ISI ranking. I don't know if it is here, but in many institutions, for example, if you publish in JAMA or New England Journal of Medicine, it's worth a 6. Otolaryngology, head and neck surgery is worth a 2. The Journal of Voice is worth a 1, okay? Whatever that is. So in other words, you'd have to publish 3 times as much in my journal to get the same value for promotion as you would in 1 in New England Journal. Advertising dollars clearly are directed towards the higher ISI journals. Subscriptions, attraction, national media, the likelihood you're going to get in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times is higher. The problem is that the downside is that manipulation of data by authors to justify submission to a higher level journal. A new discoveries where the data is still superficial but might be relegated to a less visible journal. 2 examples are the first presentation of AIDS and Lyme's disease were in smaller journals because they couldn't get in the big journals. And a perception by the public that those journals have more important things to tell, which they may not. Well, there's some very important things that are published in our journals. A quick look at levels of evidence. We were the second journal in the world to publish, to evaluate each of our articles and give it a level of evidence rating. So if you look in our abstracts, you will have a level of evidence rating of each of our articles. So just by looking in our abstract, you could tell what the level of evidence is. Basically, it's an attempt to show the not necessarily the quality of the product, but the type of research that was done. And basically, there's three ways that we do this: level of clinical evidence and primary literature. Hayes rating has to do with drugs. Did you get a Hayes rating? Do you know what Hayes rating is for your device? It has to do with drugs and devices. I'll talk about that. In general, grade A evidence is better than grade B, which is better than grade C, which is better than grade D. Grade A is supported by one or more randomized clinical controlled trials. Grade B is supported by retrospective or comparison trials, but with a cohort or a comparator group. Grade C is kind of a case series, which is about 80% of the ENT literature is grade C. And grade D is expert opinion. Sometimes these consensus panels are a lower level of evidence than our retrospective case series. And these are broken up into other levels. So here you have level 1A is a systematic review or a meta-analysis of randomized clinical trials. By the way, meta-analysis is a very specific analysis. Just because you did a systematic review does not mean it's a meta-analysis. And there's actually, go to the Cochrane website and they can tell you exactly how to do that. Individual randomized controlled trials 1B, and then you have 2A, 2B, 3A, 3B, and then 4 and 5. Now that's for all studies. The only studies that aren't included are basic science that don't include prognosis or the diagnosis, and animal research is not, there's no level of evidence for animal research. So you won't see it for that. But you can do it for therapy. That's most typically how we rate things. But you can also can for diagnosis. So for example, double-blind randomized controlled trial is necessary to get a level A evidence for therapy. For diagnosis, it only takes a controlled trial because they're different. And for prognosis, it could be you could get that same level of evidence with a cohort study. And there's specific Medline filters that you would use to do each of those. Same thing true for etiology, prevention, or quality improvement. And if maybe later I'll drop the Cochrane level of evidence thing to Brian or somebody and have you pass it out to the residents, what all the level of evidences are. A Hayes rating is a little bit different. This is really looking at standard of care for devices and drugs. The rating scales are A through D. A is the procedure, device, or drug is accepted medical practice as evidenced by abundant scientific research. So it's great. No problem with it. Level B is it's considered investigational, but it's appropriate. So balloon sinuplasty might fit this level at this point. It's safe enough. It's supported by some data, those kind of things. Maybe balloon sinuplasty falls into this one, I don't know yet, but it's the data on this procedure are promising but inconclusive regarding safety or efficacy. It's probably somewhere between the two right now. There's no clear medical consensus, and Hayes level D means this is bad stuff, so you should avoid doing it. And the Hayes levels will be applied to many drugs and devices. Value journal clubs. Journal clubs are really valuable. I mean, it's amazing how much I learn from journal clubs. It's a good venue for dialogue and discussion. It can focus on key areas, key articles, or key topics. Sometimes it brings in articles that we wouldn't normally read. So we bring in an article from JAMA, or we bring in an article from Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, where we wouldn't be reading that on a routine basis. It shows how people view things differently and different sources of opinion. From a participant standpoint, it really teaches us how to read articles critically. When you go to journal club, you're evaluating the methodology. You're evaluating whether or not the results are justified by the methods and whether the abstract reports things appropriately, etc. It's a good way to get presentation skills better. Your presentations this morning were terrific, but you get to present in a really low-key setting, but you're kind of forced to present. Is that how you do it? Junior resident presents and a senior resident kind of discusses is the backup discussant, and then everybody discusses the topic. And so there are lots of good reasons to do journal club. And I'm going to finish with this, and some of this is mine, and some of this I've stole from other people who are friends, so if there's no copyright infringement here, I hope. Basically, this is the real story of the language of science and medicine. When you read these quotes, this is what you're supposed to realize. Typical results are shown. This is the prettiest graph. Three of the samples were chosen for detailed studies because the others didn't make any sense. These results will be published in a subsequent report. I might get around to it if I have time or I get funded. It has been long known, and that's pretty common. I didn't look up the original reference. A definite trend is evident. These data are practically meaningless. While it was not been possible to provide definitive answers to the question, an unsuccessful experiment, but I still hope to get it published. In my experience once, in case after case twice, in a series of cases thrice, correct within an order of magnitude means that it's wrong. Just don't accept that. It is believed that, I think, it is generally believed that, a couple other people think so also, according to statistical analysis, rumor has it. This is a good one. A statistically oriented projection of the significance of this data is a wild guess. A careful analysis of obtainable data was the three pages of notes were obliterated when I knocked over a glass of beer. It is clear that much additional work will be required before a complete understanding of this phenomenon occurs. I don't get it. After additional study by my colleagues, they don't get it either. In a highly significant area for exploratory study, a totally useless topic selected by some committee. I'd personally like to thank Galen Garrett and Brian Berkey for their assistance with this experiment and Robert Ossoff for valuable discussions, and that means Drs. Garrett and Berkey did the work and Dr. Ossoff explained it to me. At the bottom of many of my slides, you'll have a reference. And Mike Poole, a few years back, started putting this little MTSU Poole 2002. And me and Jim Hadley and Jack Annan, we've adopted this. And when you see a little MTSU 2006, Mike Benninger, it just means we made this shit up. So, oh, you don't want to put that in the... And it is hoped that this study will stimulate further investigation in this field, which means I quit. I'm done. So with that, I'd like to just show you the transition in our new residency training program. Mickey Stewart gave this slide to me. Now that we're 5 years of ENT, so this was the former PGY1 through chief resident in surgery, and this is where we are today. So with that, I'll open up to any questions or comments.